will you? Jesus. Good morning, everybody. My name's Carla Moore, and I'm an alcoholic. And I want to start by thanking Dick and Peggy and the committee for inviting me out here to share with you guys this weekend. It's been really moving for me, and your generous spirit and enthusiasm has cracked me open one more time. And AA always does, but there's something about the spirit of the Midwest or something right here going on that has just really moved me, and I want to thank you for that. I want to thank my hostess, Lori, for meeting me at the airport and taking me anywhere I needed to go, and for being there and being a good friend. I hope that we get to stay friends after this. And Dick and Peg, for the warm welcome. When we got here, they handed me this big bag of snacks, you know, crackers and cookies and a commemorative coffee cup. And I got to the bottom of the snacks, and I don't know what they're trying to tell me, but there was a tape measure at the bottom of the bag. So, anyway, thank you for that. Thank you for... I got something out of every single speaker that spoke. I sat here mesmerized, and I am full this morning. I hope you are too. Weren't they great, these speakers this weekend? So to be standing up here at the same podium with the likes of them, and with the likes of you, I'm just sort of marinating. And I bring greetings and love from Doug R. A lot of you guys know him. He's your AA brother, so a lot of you, and big kisses. And Karen G. I got a message from her last night. And AA works wherever it's worked. You know, they're in Pennsylvania. Anyway, I'm just moved, and I hope I just don't fall down and break down into tears at the podium. I hardly ever cry, but when I do, I it's always inappropriate. So Sandy talked about forgiveness, and, if I'm going to get off the hook, it's the same all the time. If I'm going to get off the hook, I got to let you off the hook. And sometimes it's worth it for me to drag you around for a while, you know, just to drag myself around with you. I don't know. It seems so. I forget. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have told you I was an alcoholic because of the crazy, dark, dramatic, violent, perverted family I had. If you had my family, you'd drink too. And I've been around here long enough to know now that that'll give you an inventory, but it doesn't make me alcoholic. What makes me alcoholic is the fact that when I pick up a drink and I take a drink, the drink takes me, and I can't guarantee if I'm going to have two or 22. And what's worse is when I put it down for any amount of time, my life gets so uncomfortable on the inside. I just get so crazy on the inside that sooner or later, I'm going to come back to that first drink knowing full well what's going to happen, what might or might not happen. I just don't know, but I'm going to pick it up and drink it anyway. And I never knew how to stop that cycle for a long, long time. I don't want you to think my childhood was all bad, though, either, just to let you know. I mean, 4th, 5th, and 6th grade were terrific. I had a great time in elementary school. I was a new kid on the block a lot, and I like that because I've learned I adjust well. I run away a lot, but I adjust well, and for a little while until I bring it all down around me, and then I have to leave again. But I had a good time. I was very involved in sports. In order to fit in, I would be the first around the track, or really good in baseball, or best in academics. Whatever it was, I had to be on top and in charge. And you know, and by the time 6th grade was over, though, I needed a drink. I was really tired. And, you know, when you're trying to run the world at 10, it's a big job. And I got my first social resentment behind a game of spin the bottle right after 6th grade. I know they don't even play that game these days. They just get right down to business. But we... we played it back then, and I was at my friend Leonard's house, and we were passing around a bottle of his dad's whiskey, and And we spun the bottle, and the bottle landed on me, and I went off into the bedroom with one of the boys, and we were both doing the same thing as far as I could tell, but when we came back out of that bedroom, they called him a player and me a slut, and I did not think that was fair. I still don't think it's fair, but every sponsor I've ever had has told me the fair is in Pomona, and it lasts 2 weeks. That's all you get. But even back then, I did not know how to accept the things I couldn't change. I didn't know how to just roll with the punches and learn as you go. It seemed to me I really started to get the idea that, like every speaker has said over the weekend, that you had the manual for living and I didn't. I just didn't know how to roll with the punches. I beat my head against the wall and couldn't figure out why you wouldn't move the wall. And again, just keep at it like a dog with a bone. And those weren't my first drinks, but those were the drinks where I started to really make a connection that alcohol would do something for me that I couldn't do for myself. And alcohol became for me that instant maturity, an instant cool, an instant smooth the edges off my life. I just loved the effect alcohol had on me, and I started to do it as often as I could. And but I got a reputation that I didn't understand, nor could I take responsibility for in junior high. You know, when you're a girl like me, my sponsor calls it being a friendly girl. Girls my age were looking at me funny, and boys my age were looking at me funny, and I got my feelings hurt, and I did what I do when my feelings get hurt. My pride kicks in, and I start to back away from my life. And school, which had been a big refuge for me, started to be the enemy. There was not any friendly direction in that area anymore either. So I started spending more time in the girls' room than I did in the classroom, and I started hanging out with the other girls who were backing away from their lives. And we'd share the stuff we brought from our mother's medicine cabinets and from their liquor cabinets, and until it was just over, until school just wasn't working for me anymore. And I don't know about you, but I always felt like hope was just up the road. You know, I'm a runaway from way back, and all it takes for me really is a Willie Nelson song and a long, slow train whistle, and I'm on the road again. You know, I started to get out there on that 10 freeway going east and the 101 freeway going north, and I'd get on that on-ramp, and I'd stick my little thumb out on that on-ramp and crawl in the car or the truck going wherever with whoever, and I'd be on my way to somewhere else. And I love that feeling. Hope is just up the road. You know, it always felt like the bottle in the glove compartment for me, that any minute now it's all going to be okay. And to this day, when we drive up the 101 and we pass Ventura and we see that first sign that says San Francisco, I just get a little tinge, you know, a little tingle, a little goosebumps, you know. Ooh. But today I like going home, and I have a home to go to, which is a big plus. I like that too. But I started to run, and it started to seem like the outsides were matching the insides more for me. You know, I started to meet more people like me and more people that were doing what I'd been doing, and it just seemed to be where I'd found relief. And the more I'd go out on the road, the less I felt at home, you know, the less I was able to reintegrate back into my school. And I certainly wasn't going to tell them where I'd been on my summer vacation, that's for sure. Because I had been starting to spend a little time in the Southern California hotspots, like Indio Jail and Riverside Juvenile Hall and L.A. Central Juvenile Hall. And nobody else in my school was really doing that. And when I was 14, I found myself in a place called North Beach in the San Francisco area, where a couple of guys offered my friend and I money for sex. And we said yes and did the next indicated thing. And boom, a whole new career path opened up for us. And I started living a day at a time in a way I've not had to live in a very, very long time. And I started letting old men stick needles in my arms, and my life became a whole different deal. Like I said, the outside started to match the insides, and I was meeting more and more people like me. And when I was 15, the courts took over, and I was admitted to a mental hospital. It wasn't a treatment center, because they didn't really have them that back then. They were sort of starting to bubble up, and there were a few. But this was a mental hospital. And to this day, I like to do H&I in those hospitals. I like to find the hidden alcoholics, because when I was admitted there, they weren't talking to me a lot about alcoholism, that's for sure. They were talking to me about disorders, because I was a very disordered-looking child. I was alternately violent and withdrawn, and living with a level of frustration in my gut that I've not had to experience in a very, very long time. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I heard it described as like being a scream without a mouth, and I so identified with that. That's how I felt. I certainly didn't know how to talk about what had been going on, and I just felt that like a pressure cooker. And And I became intimately familiar with five-point restraints. They were giving me daily nutritional supplements of Thorazine, Melaril, Valium, Dalmane sleepers. I guess they were afraid I wouldn't sleep. And if you don't want to go crazy in the nut house, you got to get busy. And one of my favorite ways to be busy, I've already told you, was boys. I loved all the boys, but my favorites were those sexy, smoldering types, you know? You know the kind. Some of you do. I can hear you. They're just sitting back there simmering, you know? You just never really know when they're going to blow. And I loved that. Now, today I know that feeling is fear. Back then, I found them very exciting. And the trouble with guys in the nut house that are like that is that you're always having to say goodbye to them because they blow. And then they're off to California Youth Authority or whatever the lockup is. And like my first boyfriend was hauled off for throwing a chair through the window, and my next boyfriend was hauled off for throwing a nurse through the window. So that was progressive, too. And they used to play those romantic lockup jailhouse songs, you know, back then, like, ooh, when will I see you again? And I've always thought I should have a soundtrack to my life, right? You know, music playing in the background of all this sweet drama. And I remember one afternoon sitting outside the girls' unit on the smoke break bench watching my boyfriend Terry being cuffed and escorted off by security. He's the one who threw the chair through the window. And it was agony, you know, and I was smoking my tragic cigarettes and watching this whole terrible scene go down. And just inside the girls' unit, I could hear Diana Ross singing at top decibel, "Touch Me in the Morning," and just walk away. You know, I was brokenhearted and blue before I ever had a real date. And I was always looking out there for what I thought would fix me, you know. And I was always about half a bubble off what I thought it was anyway. You know, I was always reaching. I didn't know it was counterfeit. I mistook brute strength for strength of character. I mistake sex for love. I mistake arrogance for confidence, you know. And I get it up close to me and it turns to dust. It's not real. And even if it was, if it came from out there, there'd never be enough for me. It took coming to Alcoholics Anonymous for me to find that it's when I give of myself that gaping hole in my soul gets smaller. But I didn't know that, and I chased it. Even with all the trouble that it caused, alcohol was still my best friend. It was still my solution. It was still the thing that I looked for. And I was supposed to be in that hospital for 2 weeks, and I ended up being there for a year. I just sort of moved in and made myself at home, And every now and then I'd get antsy, you know, and I'd find my way over the fence or under the gate, or I don't know whose bright idea it was to send us through to parent group through the front lobby, which had an unlocked door. And every now and then I'd put my street clothes on under my pajamas. And if you time it just right and everybody's looking the other way, boy, boom, you know, and hit the street and you know, take off the pajamas around the corner. And I'd make it for a week or two out there. And I'd go out, have a little party, and come back in the front door of the nut house because that was my home. That's where I lived. And so when I was done, I'd come back. And I went from the girls' unit to the co-ed unit to Ward D, which is the ward where they put the people that they don't know what to do with anymore. And I was there under court order. So by then, I was no longer getting dressed or bathing because you don't have to do that to date in the nut house. And always sat in my queen spot in the day room. I had casts on both my arms up to my shoulders because I'd been cutting, because that's a whole different way to alter my reality when I don't have a drink. And so I'd sit there and smoke my cigarettes, and I met the love of my life there on that unit. He was admitted early one morning, and it took me a long time to realize I think there was something wrong with him too. I always think it's just me. He was admitted early one morning, and I was sitting there in the day room in all my glory, and he looked across the room and saw a vision for you and said, "Her, I gotta have her." So anyway, I ended up going over the wall with him, and we lasted about 2.5 weeks, and it took me a little while, but I realized that he called my probation officer. She knew right where to find me, and I was 16, he was 22, and I was coming off Thorazine, and he introduced me to cocaine, and I think it was just too much of a contrast for him or something, I don't know, but... And I rolled into juvenile hall and into a rehab, and they just didn't know. My dad tells me today, you know, they were just trying to buy you some time, Carla, just trying to buy you some time. And I was always sitting in front of a judge waiting for placement. And go in, and I'd get started, and I'd see, man, this is a really great thing, but it just didn't stick, and I wasn't interested. Because after all, I still had that lurking notion that alcohol would do it for me. It still did. It wasn't like I didn't believe in God either. I've always believed in God. I felt the presence of God long before I ever took a drink, the real presence of God. I mean, I really knew. Underneath church, underneath all of those things, I felt I've experienced forgiveness. But man, when I discovered what alcohol would do, it was just so much quicker than sitting around waiting for God's will, you know? And what if I didn't like God's will? I could take a drink and I didn't care anymore what God's will was. And somewhere along the line, I sort of secretly surrendered to the thought that perhaps maybe I was one of those little nut house lifers, too, that maybe I get to spend a little time on the outside, but I was going to end up back in, and someday for good. I hated it, and it's been mentioned a few times this weekend, I hated those moments when there's another speaker named Amanda, and she says that, you know, no matter how insane she got, she always knew when she was lying to herself, And somewhere in there, I relate to that. Way deep down, when it gets real quiet, you know, I would feel that and wonder what the hell is wrong with me too. I ended up in a girls' home finally at the end of all of that in Pasadena, and I met my roommate. And we were seekers; always been a seeker. You know, it's just that the unfortunate thing for me is that for an alcoholic is that everything I used to seek with were the very things that were blocking me from God. So. But we searched with a vengeance. And the best idea of some power greater than myself that I could get, I mean, I was born into a Southern Baptist home, and my mother found great strength in that church. And I tried being a Catholic for a couple of weeks in the fourth grade. Then I burned black candles for a couple of years and prayed to the other guy for a while, just hedging my bets, really. I just want to be on the side that's winning. I don't care. Then the television series Kung Fu came out. Some of you guys might remember that show, and David Carradine played the lead, and he was a Shaolin priest, walked the Wild West in bare feet, that guy did, and pearls of wisdom just rolled off his tongue. If you saw the show, you know what I'm saying, and he could change your life in three words, and just very, you know, but... The best part about him was when they messed with him, he kicked their ass. And to me, it was balance. It was the perfect combination of strength and serenity. That's all I ever wanted, you know. And so I'm, you know, fast forward back into this girl's home, and combine that with my love for what I thought the 60s were all about. They were, you know, there was peace and love and flowers and all of that stuff. And I just loved that good music and Grateful Dead and Crosby, Stills, and Nash. And I loved them. But I was 12 in 1969, so the 60s were over by the time I got out in the world. But I carried it with me. And people stood up for themselves in the 60s. And so I've got this going on. I'm 17 in a girl's home with my roommate, and all of our friends said, man, those people moved to Oregon. You got to go to Oregon. So, man, we went down out the second story window and down the tree and into Randy's truck up to Oregon, where God might be. And they moved. They rented a little house and they let me come with them. And two things happened that I could see looking back. We couldn't always drink the way I needed to drink. I wasn't doing what I'd been doing to make a living. When they talk about hoeing up there, they meant with a garden tool. It was just a whole different. When I have no booze, I had no drink, I had no God in my understanding, no sufficient substitute, no steps, no fellowship, no God. I am restless, irritable, and discontent, very hard to get along with. And when I could drink the way I needed to drink, I was always overshooting the mark. And that was happening again and still at 17. And my friends eventually had to ask me to leave, and I was asked to leave a lot. And I ended up back down in my father's house, and And we hadn't been together in a few years, and he let me stay against his better judgment. And every morning we'd get up at the same time, and he'd take off for work, and I'd go into his den, and I'd start drinking from his liquor cabinet. Why he had this liquor cabinet, I have no idea. He didn't drink a drop anymore. He was scared to death of alcohol. Alcoholism runs through my family like the Colorado River. And yet he had this dispute. I thought, it's there for me. And I'd get up every day, and I'd start drinking, and he'd come home to find me sitting in the same place where he left me, and he'd have that brokenhearted look in his eyes, like we all know. We've all seen it. And finally, right before my 18th birthday, he had to ask me to leave. He came to me, and he said what I know were the hardest words he ever had to say to his oldest daughter, and that's, I'm not going to watch you die, and I'm not going to help you do it. You got to go. And on my way out the door, all I could remember was that one of the counselors at the rehab had told me I was a great actress. And I know today I must have misunderstood, but I ended up on Hollywood Boulevard. And there's not a lot of auditioning going on out there, I can promise you. I was 18 years old, start my days off with a pint of pop-off vodka, and I would go wherever the day took me. And some days it was a party, and some days it was just surviving. I love it when a young lady asks me to drive her to Hollywood if she's living there or maybe staying at a recovery home, or I get to sponsor her for a while. And we drive right past that same bus stop on Sunset Boulevard at Poinsettia Avenue, and I see a whole new generation of the same girl sitting out there with very little hope about it getting any different. And I say a prayer of gratitude for me and a prayer of hope for her, because, man, it gets bleak out there. And a few months into that, I met a man walking down Hollywood Boulevard, and I saw the light in his eyes, and I didn't realize it was orange sunshine, but we hit it off, and I moved in with him that night, and I didn't even know his last name, and 6 weeks later, he's asking me to leave, and I still don't know his last name, but I like to bring him up, because years later, he was on my eight-step list. He was someone who came to mind very quickly and clearly. I owed him amends. He'd been nothing but kind to me, and I'd gone through his life in 6 weeks. Spiritually, materially, physically, mentally, in every way I could. And I knew I owed him amends. So I spent the last part of my first year looking for him, and I couldn't find him. It took a while. My sponsor finally said, you know, you're just going to have to set that down for a while. You're going to have to leave it alone. If you're supposed to find him, you will. And that's in God's time. So you set it down for a while. And she said, there are some things you can do to change yourself in the meantime. There are things you can do, you know, like try being a friend to a man in a vertical fashion. Why don't you start there? A lot of the changing that's happened in me has happened with those little... none of the stuff you ever said, too, for me to do has ever sounded like a good idea to begin with. You know, I never went running up going, yeah, let's do that. But it's worked out well. right before my 13th AA birthday, I had to go give a talk on the other side of town, and it was a hot Sunday afternoon, and I didn't feel like going. And thank God you guys have taught me it's not how I feel, it's what I do that matters. And you taught me how to show up. Showing up is one of my favorite things still. It's so basic, and as scared as I am, I know if I just show up, just get there, it's going to be different. And I used to think I could blow off a dinner for two and not be missed, really. You know, I just... and I don't care, really. I just want to be invited. I don't really want to go anyway, but... So I went and I gave the talk, and of course I felt better. And at the end of that meeting, when the thank you line came through, this man stopped and he said, where were you in 1976? And it was a guy from Hollywood Boulevard standing in front of me with 8.5 years of sobriety, and I with almost 13. And only a very well-organized, loving God could have made that happen when I, in all my efforts to get that done, couldn't get it done. Wasn't time. And it occurred to me later that had I found him in my first year of sobriety, he wasn't sober yet. Maybe he wouldn't have got it quite the way he did when it was when he was 8.5. Again, I can't question God's time, but I like to tell that story because it reminds me, even today, that God's timing is always perfect, even when I don't think things are happening fast enough or just right. There's a very, very subtle difference between my power and God's power, you know. I'm letting it flow for a while, then all of a sudden I think I'm going to help God out. And I don't always know exactly where that's happened. I can only see it looking back, like when I'm beat up and bloody and, So I got to make those direct amends to him, and he said, oh my God, Carla, that's long forgiven, long forgotten. I just can't believe you're still alive. And he's right, you know. If we're in this room this morning, we're the lucky ones. Somehow, some way, we've managed to step through that window of grace one more midnight, one more day, to stand or sit together here and stay sober another day. and just sit close. I'm so glad if you're new, I'm so glad that they didn't tell me it was going to be comfortable when I got here. I'm so glad, because it's not always comfortable, but it's been worth every step, absolutely every step. Changing everything about me, having everything changed about me and the way I see things and the way I do things even still is not always comfortable. But man, I love the result, so I'm willing to do it, willing to stay. But that was a long time to come, and I ended up living that year out in Hollywood and hooking up with another guy from another rehab. And, you know, the rehabs are full of boyfriends and girlfriends and things like that. And we loved the idea of peace and love again, still flying on the coattails of the 60s. And we just couldn't stop knocking the hell out of each other really long enough to implement the principles fully of peace and love. And we beat each other up and down the California coast. I've got the soundtrack, Bob Dylan and Jackson Browne, playing in my head. You know, we're sleeping by the side of the road, and we pitched a tent in the mountains in southern Oregon, and we lived there till the rains came. And then we moved into a roofless cabin just north of Grants Pass, threw a plastic tarp over the top, called it a skylight until the baby came. We had this little girl, and I thought this little girl was going to change my focus. Now I've got a priority, right? If I have to take care of somebody else, and I love that little girl. You know, but we all know alcoholism does not care who you love. It just doesn't care. And after a while, my priority was still alcohol. And I was drinking those herbal drinks. I mean, homemade beer, homemade wine, homemade moonshine, you know. Much better for you. Still didn't matter. When she was about 10 months old, she got in the way of one of our fights, and I had to take her up to Idaho, where it's got to be better somewhere else. Hope is just up the road, right? And I bring her up there, and I've got three jobs up there. I'm tending bar and cocktail waitressing, and never occurred to me not to drink on the job. Why else would you have those jobs? And was making good money, and I still couldn't bring home enough money to pay rent for more than a week at a time. So we lived in those little rent-by-the-week motels up there. And my daughter was one of those kids by then that you see in her T-shirt and underwear and yesterday's lunch down the front of it because her mom's not paying attention. And after a while, of course, Idaho's not working for us anymore. I'm drinking straight scotch. You know, I'd long given up the mixers because those things give you a hell of a hangover, really, and not good for you at all. And we're back down in L.A., and I'm renting a room for my aunt in Covina, and I've got a job in Hollywood, which was, you know, I don't know, 30 miles away or so, I guess. And my daughter was almost 4 years old. Every afternoon, I'd kiss her goodbye, and I'd take off for the bar in Hollywood. And I'd stop at the halfway point, which is a bar in Arcadia called the First Cabin. And I'd stop in there and I'd have my primer drinks, those drinks that got me ready to get up and go do my shift in Hollywood. And I'd get up every day and go out to Hollywood and pour drinks and drink till the wee hours of the morning and start all over again. And one afternoon, I kissed my girl goodbye as I had done months on end. And I took off for the bar in Hollywood, stopped at the same halfway point, same place, same First Cabin, had those same shots of gold and same Bud backs. Really, I couldn't tell what had been different on that day than the day before. The only thing to this day that I see was 24 hours. That's all it was. And I sat on that bar stool and I couldn't stop. I couldn't suspend my drinking long enough to get up and go take care of business in either direction. I couldn't get up, couldn't get off the bar stool, couldn't stop drinking. And I sat on the bar stool there and I lost them both. The kid and the job were gone. One fell swoop, they were gone. And I stayed and I lived off the kindness of strangers there in that little area in Arcadia for about a month. And I'd travel around the little Devil's Triangle out there. I'd start at the Drinker's Hall of Fame in the morning and then go down to Steerburger and into Tommy T's and up to Kelly's and then back into the First Cabin. And about midnight, I'd be listening to the band play and the booze would be wearing off and the chatter in my head would be rising up. And I'd start thinking about my daughter. And I knew that you could walk her up to me and say, you know, Carla, you could have her back if you just stopped drinking. I knew that wasn't going to happen. And I couldn't have told you in these words, but alcohol had become my master, my absolute master. And today I'm conceited to the fact and perfectly okay with the fact that if Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't remain my priority, alcohol will again become it. It's the only way. It's the only time I've ever done anything, remain sober for any amount of time, in any comfortable, with any semblance of comfortability. I had to stop calling and asking her how she was doing because she was asking me those hard questions like, Mommy, when are you coming to get me? And I had no idea. I just knew she was better off where she was. And I fell into another job in another dive bar, and now the people and the places and me were all getting increasingly rustic. And I thought, I thought maybe getting married might do the trick. Maybe if I got married and it made my life look like I thought yours was, get the kid back, move into an apartment, take care of him, take care of her, just move off the street. I've been in this business too long. It's just wearing on me, you know. And he and I got married about the time we should have split up, and we moved into that apartment, and we became an active household. I threw the first punch in that relationship because I just know how it goes. I know the rhythm of this whole thing by now. I watch him lumbering at me, and I just know I better make it good. And I developed a pretty good right cross. We bought ourselves a big gun to protect ourselves from the night stalker, and the only people we ever turned that gun on was each other. I just tried to get to it first. My first exposure to Alcoholics Anonymous was after one of those fights. We were at the bar where we drank, and we were fighting over whether or not I should get off the bar stool, and I lost that fight, and I ended up with some black eyes and broken ribs, and nobody feeling sorry for me in that bar, just glad I was leaving. And my husband had to pick me up and take me to the hospital, and I can't tell you the amount of times I always had him at cross purposes, you know, having to save my life and kill me at the same time, you know. So he brought me to the hospital. I got fixed up, and he brought me home. And he had to go to work out of town that weekend. And before he left, he set me up with a giant ice chest full of beer and a bottle of Beefeater gin chilling on top. And now I'm drinking gin because tequila had been making me so mean. You understand, right? And I started drinking and dialing. And I don't know all of who I called, but I know I felt like a battered woman. So I called a battered woman shelter, and I asked the woman who answered the phone to fix my life. And she asked me if I'd ever been to an AA meeting. And I don't know how she made that leap, really, but she did. So what I heard her say was that if I went to an AA meeting, she'd fix my life. So I went off to an AA meeting. And sometimes I'm really glad that I heard what I heard and not what they said, you know. It just, you know, and I hope today that you hear what you need to hear, whether I say it or not, you know, because it, you know, it just works out better that way. When I was new, I had some kind of weird obsession. I can't remember what it was. It was so important, and I went to my friend, and I told her about it, and I asked her what to do. She gave me some little, you know, pray or something to do about it, and she was right. You know, it was gone in a very short time. And I went back to her and I said, "Man, what you told me to do really worked." And she said, "Well, tell me what it was. I want to know." And so I told her what it was, and she said, "That's not what I said." And I said, "Well, tell me what you said then." And she told me, and I said, "Well, that wouldn't help me at all." So I'm glad I heard what she said. I don't know. Bill C. always says God gets in the middle, you know, of what we say and what we hear, I guess. Anyway, I went to that meeting that night. It was a perfectly wonderful meeting. It was there. It's still there. And I went in, and the one thing that I wasn't was ready. And it's something you can't give to me. We all have to come to those terms on our own. And I walked in there, and two very kind women sat me down and gave me the newcomer packet and a tissue. And it was a tissue and a cup of coffee. And I was feeling very, very sorry for myself. And I heard the woman talk. I mean, it was a perfectly wonderful meeting, and she talked for a long, long time, and the only thing I heard her say was that somewhere during her drinking career, she switched to beer, so I did. And walked out of there thinking, AA says switch to beer. And after that, you know, beer gets a bad rap, but to me, it gave me the illusion I was controlling my drinking. You know, it just was so soothing. My body was ready for it. You know, I came to, I had beer, I drank beer all day. It allowed me to have some sense of a life. I was taking care of kids, and I wasn't employable, but I was taking care of kids at home, and as long as we stuck to videos on the TV and cooking, I was okay most of the time. And beer just gave me that illusion, and I was down to 110 pounds then, and I had that distended liver and those sunken eyes and swollen cheeks, and I wasn't in great health, and beer allowed me to last another couple of years. We ended up getting evicted from that apartment and ended up living in a little room in his ex-wife's backyard. None of us liked that very much, and so I got a little alcoholic willpower. I needed to get out of there, and I started answering phones for the city, and a whole different kind of alcoholic torture started then. You know, some mornings I would try to just get from home to the job without taking those morning drinks. Can I just do that? Can I just get from here to there and last till noon without those morning drinks? Let's just try that. And I found that when I wasn't drinking, I was thinking about drinking, and that's all that was happening. And some days I'd make it, and some days I wouldn't. And that lasted a year. And our relationship, my marriage, everything culminated in one more of those Saturday afternoons where the cops are in the driveway one more time. The neighbors are peeking out the window at Charlie and Carla's house, wondering what's going on one more time. The kid's now she's 10 years old, standing over there in the corner, and she's got that look of fear in her eyes one more time. Finally, the cops left, the husband left, they took the gun, everybody's gone, it's me and the kid and the beer sitting in our little apartment. I'm in a better financial position than I've been in a very, very long time. I'm living indoors, I've got a little car even, I've got a little job, I'm hanging on to that by a thread, but better financial position, better on the outside than I've been in many, many years, and yet I'm dying of alcoholism more than ever. I can't stop drinking. I can't stop drinking. I see my life falling down around me, and I can't stop drinking. And no amount of rationalization or logic can touch that. And my first sponsor told me if I wanted to effect a conscious contact with a power greater than myself, that I could start by counting the coincidences that happened in my life. And one of the first ones I could count was that I had moved in next door to a woman who had 5 years of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she had seen and heard that whole fight go down. And a couple days later, she knocked on my door and she brought me a big book and a 12 and 12. And she sat on my couch and she told me her story. And in her story, I could tell that she used to drink like me. And over the last year, I'd seen with my own eyes that she wasn't drinking anymore. And what impressed me more about her was it didn't seem to bother her that she wasn't drinking. And that got my attention, you know, because I remember back in the days, you know, when I've got no booze, I've got no sufficient substitute, no steps, fellowship, no God of my understanding, I feel like you've stripped the coating off my wires. You know, I feel oversensitive and underloved, and I don't know what you meant by that or why you looked at me that way. And my life gets so uncomfortable from there. The inside of my head, the noise goes up, and sooner or later I'm going to be looking at that first drink and knowing full well what might or might not happen, I'm going to pick that drink up and drink it because that's the only solution I got. And even though that window of grace gets smaller and smaller and smaller, I can't stop drinking. So I don't know if her little thinly veiled 12 Sunday school principles are going to be quite big enough to handle somebody as extra crazy as me. You know, I just, not in the face of what I had become, I just didn't think they would touch me, you know. And I thought back to the days of in the mental hospital where 5-point restraints was a way that they dealt with me. And so I just don't know. And it seemed like it was working for her. About a week and a half later, I just didn't go back and buy any more beer. I sat in my apartment for 3 days and shook and saw and heard things that weren't there. And by Tuesday afternoon, I went back to my neighbor and I asked her what to do. I was pretty sick, and she sent me up to a meeting in Sierra Madre. And she said, not that there'll be any big question, but go up there and tell them that you're new. And so I went up there and I raised my hand and sat way back by the exit sign just in case. And I heard a lot of hope in that room. And the hope I heard, I don't know why, came in the form of small talk. Everybody seemed to be interested in what the other was doing. Now, that was to the untrained eye. Now I know that everybody was talking, nobody's listening. That's really what it was. But I sat back, and at the end of that meeting, and I'll tell you, we read chapter 5, that portion of chapter 5, at just about every meeting I've ever been to. But at my first home group, they also read a portion of chapter 3, and that's the one that I got. That's the one that told me you guys knew something about me that I really couldn't put my finger on. You know, I hadn't quantified it quite like that, and it was there in that portion of chapter 3, and so I really love it. And I love it when people are quiet during the readings, too, because until I could talk to you, that's all I had. That's all I had that pulled me into the room. At the end of that meeting, the secretary asked me to read that portion of A Vision for You that we read at the end of a lot of meetings, a portion of chapter 11, and I said yes this time. I stuck out my hand and I said yes. And if you ask me all these years later, yes is still the best answer in Alcoholics Anonymous, still the best. It pulls me into the room every time you ask me to set up chairs or find that newcomer a cup of coffee or go pick that newcomer up or wash ashtrays or cups or whatever it is. It pulls me into the room just a little bit. And when I have to be here, it keeps me in a posture of hearing and delivering the message. When my spirit, when my head, when nothing can catch up, you know, I'm in this room. And I never know who's going to walk by and give me some one-liner, new or old. I don't know, you know. I don't know who's walking behind me who's going to be trying to hang on themselves, and they're going to see me still here and say, well, maybe if Carla can do it, I can too. Just one more day. So all these jobs, I thank God. My favorite commitment was a coffee commitment. And And they gave that to me. I had to drink one more time at 89 days. That first step edge, I call it, was just coming back up. It seemed to me that balance was more of a big book and a beer. You know, I just and I just couldn't take it anymore. But as soon as I took those first drinks, I knew that I wanted what I'd had just a few minutes earlier, and I was willing to go to any lengths to get it if I could come back. And that drunk lasted another 24 hours, and my sponsor came and got me that Friday night, and she picked me up, and she took me up to the big book study, and after I finished the beers, I wasn't in great shape that night, and you guys didn't even wait till I was sober. You asked me if I wanted to come. Somebody asked me if I wanted to come up Tuesday and make coffee with them, and I thought, geez, somebody thinks I'm going to be here Tuesday. And I came, somewhere along the line, they faded out of the coffee commitment, but I took it over. And, you know, those old-timers are smart that way. And I got out of work at 5 o'clock, and I was in the meeting at 5:05, because the meeting, even though the meeting didn't start till 8 o'clock, because I'm in the store, and I'm buying stir sticks and coffee and creamer, and I'm thinking about you. And whenever I'm thinking about you, the noise on the inside of my head goes down, you know? And that's when I learned about the absence of self-centeredness, you know, the other-centeredness. And I didn't get that term when you were calling it self-centered. I thought, I can't be. I'm a mom. I can't be self-centered. And I have no idea. I was a terrible mom, so I don't know how I equated that, but that was my delusion. So I love those commitments. And I got a sponsor. I've always had a sponsor. I've had a few sponsors. Some people are fortunate to have the same sponsor the whole time. Every sponsor I've ever had has walked me to the next. And had I had my dependence on that sponsor instead of God, then when she left Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 2 years sober, I might have had to go with her. But I didn't. She taught me about a God of my understanding. And AA was working for me, and so I just walked up to the next. And every sponsor I've ever had has been that for me. I worked the steps in my first year, and I made that first round of amends to my family. I owed them the most. I'd broken their hearts on a consistent basis and needed to make those amends on a consistent basis. It required a lot of follow-up. And if you're new, I just want to tell you that I was about 12 years sober when my father finally was able to stop telling me the story about how he used to sit up nights and watch the news to make sure my name wasn't on the list of the victims of the serial killers of the day. There was a Signal Hill killer or Hillside Strangler and Green River and all of those guys, and my dad sat in front of the news hoping he didn't hear my name, expecting to, though. And when I was about 12 years sober, and I took him out for Father's Day or something for lunch, and we were talking, and he was starting to go into this story again. You know, I have no pictures of you when you were a teenager, And I understood, but sometimes, you know, I'm an impatient alcoholic. I think that it should have been done about 11 and a half years ago, that this whole thing, and this whole broken heart thing, you know, why can't you get over it? And I'm sitting here thinking, you know, I think that I've given him his due, and I've got sharp objects right here. But I'm listening intently, And he says, but, you know, to see you over these last few years, he said, I wouldn't trade what you have and who you are today for all the pictures in the world. And see, if I'd have stabbed him, I'd have missed that. Alcoholics Anonymous was the only place I was staying sober, and you told me things like go out there and do something for somebody and don't get caught, and that would keep me busy all till the next meeting. And I was going to 2 and 3 meetings a day. I'd run out of work for lunch and run up the street to Altadena Drive and go to that meeting until I had to come back in and be there. And I'd go to the early meeting and then the later meeting and then come back and start all over again. And 2 and 3 meetings a day for a couple of years, you know. I was busy being wonderful in Alcoholics Anonymous, and Brenda talked about this yesterday, you know. And on page 19 in our book, it doesn't wait till the very end, it says on page 19 that a more important demonstration of our principles happens in our homes, occupations, and affairs. And if I'm only doing it in these rooms, I'm only half doing it. And so I'm almost 2 years sober. My daughter's starting to come home at all hours of the night, beat up and bloody. She's been jumped into a gang, and she's starting to find her sense of family and camaraderie out in the street where I used to. And I'm getting scared for her. And I don't really know what to do. I know that she's got a God, but for a little while, the people of Alcoholics Anonymous were able to help me with some things, but she needed bigger help for a little while. And it was time. You know, up until then, I probably needed every single meeting I'd been to, but now it was time to change, and the signals were very, very large. And I had to put her in a treatment center for a little while. She was there for about 6 months. I had to lie to her to get her there, and I felt bad. And I sat down, and I was worried about signing her life away, you know, and worried if I was doing the right thing. And just then, I felt a hand on my shoulder, and I looked up, and it was one of the guys from my home group. And he used to work with the adolescent center across town, where I used to pick up girls and take them to meetings on Saturday afternoons. And now someone was going to be there for my daughter, and I knew that she was going to be okay. And then I looked down the hall, and I saw another guy from my home group who had become a counselor there. He was a recreational counselor, and I knew that she was going to be okay. And she was there for about 6 months, and that was where my big amends started, you know, for her, the real ones, I couldn't be guaranteed a relationship with her when she was done. There was no making a deal about that, but there were still things that I needed to do and show up for her so that she could stand on a good and stand a chance to a good life. And she was there about 6 months. And you guys taught me then that mountains are moved a spoonful at a time. And all I had to do was really worry about today's spoonful and do the best I could. And so I showed up whenever they asked me to. When I was working, I was getting better jobs because I was showing up doing what they asked me to do instead of what I thought I should do. And when she came home, things were better, but they weren't perfect. And she wanted to go live with her father for a little while, and it was time for me to step back and let her go do that, pick her up on my weekends. And I was continuing to be active in Alcoholics Anonymous and continuing to work. And when I was about 5 years sober, just a couple months after I turned five, I'd come home from the gym one night and took my shower as usual. And I always find it necessary to tell you I took a shower when I came home from the gym. And I went to bed, and I woke up in the middle of the night to a man standing over my bed with a knife to my neck and his hand over my mouth. And he said, "Don't say a word or I'll cut your head off." And he took the telephone cord and he tied my hands behind my back and he raped me and he robbed me that night in my room. And I want to tell you that at 5 years of sobriety, I had a much bigger God than I got here with. When I got here, I was what the 12 and 12 calls the bewildered one. I had just tasted so many different spiritual practices and teachings and things, and I'd really never got my hands on any one. And I really didn't know what to believe. And when I got here, I was so confused. And a lady named Susan said, "Why don't you just call him God and let him get as big as he needs to be?" And it came in the form in the beginning of the group. And then I knew that sooner or later I was going to need something that held me in good stead in the middle of the night at those early hours, or when the phones were busy, and when somehow or other I couldn't get a hold of another human being. There was going to have to be something inside that could sustain me. And over time, it did. I mean, my gods got bigger and bigger. I started out with the trouble God, you know. I had a lot of trouble. And then I got the parking space God for a little while, and I liked him. Then that God taught me that if I want to park here, get here early, is what I learned. And, you know, I'm in charge of the footwork, and he's in charge of the results. Emmett Fox calls us the spark of the divine, and I like that. Now I feel more a part of what I believe in than apart from. And I just saw a really great movie the other day, and she put it in the best form. After 22 years of searching, I couldn't figure out quite how to quantify it or how to phrase it. And in this movie, she says, "God shines through me as me." And I love that. I love it. It was perfect, simple, easy. I got it. But at 5 years, I've got a God, and there's a guy on my back in the middle of my room in the middle of the night, and I don't know quite what's going to happen, but I do know that things are going to turn out the way that they're supposed to. I no longer have that immature God that exists when things go my way and doesn't exist when things don't go my way. I know that God is or he isn't, and the second step asked me to choose that, one way or the other, and I got nothing to lose by choosing to believe that God's everything. And we got into a little tussle after a few hours, and he ended up going out the same window he came in. And it turned out that I had known him. I'd watched him get sober 30 days before I did. I watched him get his life, his wife, his kids, and everything back. And then I watched him join the church, leave AA behind. And when he went out like that. And what I choose to learn from that is that while the big book tells us to be quick to see where religious people are right, this is where I learned the terms and conditions of my disease. This is where I learned that I'm not one of those people who can go home after a Sunday sermon and have a glass of wine. I can't go to that afternoon picnic and have a glass of Chablis. And here I come first. And then I can go anywhere I want to and worship. Or nowhere. Some people choose to go nowhere and just read. And I like to find those spiritual practices that are based on those principles of love and service, and there are a lot of them. My sponsor told me I was going to have to forgive this guy, and I know she's right. You know, we're people who can't handle even seemingly justifiable resentments, but this guy had scared me. I'd stand on the street, and I'd hear a car door slam, and I'd jump, and I'd get pissed. And I don't like anybody owning me like that. You know, I just don't. And anger was my favorite. At 5 years of sobriety, it was still my best defense. It was, God, it made me feel like I had a purpose and like you can't hurt me. Focus. And yet it was like a suit that didn't fit anymore. I couldn't be angry and I could not be angry. And I stood at those crossroads too. And that seven-step prayer became my mantra. And I knew she was right, but I didn't know how to find it. And I had to keep looking. And thank God it's in the looking. It's in the seeking that that eventually those pieces come together. But there was a trial that followed. They found him a couple weeks later. And as part of the defense, they had all the guys I had known, or a lot of the guys I'd known years before in the bars, come up and testify as to who I used to be, including my ex-husband. Now, that's the mark I left on him, was the fact that he was more inclined to testify on behalf of a rapist than he was for me, and that's how I left him. He's never been interested in any of my amends, and I finally had to leave that alone. Then we had to get a character witness for me, and by then I was working at a big investment firm downtown Los Angeles. It's a place I never even would have walked in the front doors of years before. And the division head there volunteered to be a character witness for me, and he came in, and they told him all about who I used to be. And he said, yeah, but she shows up early, and she stays late, and she was where she said she was. And see, that's Alcoholics Anonymous speaking for itself. He didn't have to be coached. He just got up and told the truth as he'd experienced it through me. And that's you. All I did was what you asked me to do. And then it was my turn to testify, and I'm still looking. I'm still looking for that crack in the doorway that's going to lead me into that forgiveness where I can relinquish this terrible fear. And I'm sitting in the witness stand, and I finally see him looking out. I look out, and I see him sitting at the defense table. And it's a place where I've sat before, and I could sit again easily. And it occurred to me that what stood between he and I at that time was a drink. And if I were to take a drink, maybe it wouldn't be rape, but it could be something equally as destructive. And what happened for me was we became two alcoholics sitting on opposite sides of the courtroom. And for just a moment, like those, you know, the mechanics for forgiveness are laid out there in that book. And he was sick like me. He was sick like me. And just a crack of light came in through that doorway, and I was able to start to relinquish that fear, to start. And it took about 18 months before all those nightmares and all the stuff attendant to something like that finally disappeared, but they did. And they come back to visit every now and then. I'd get a letter from the prison after many years and saying he was going to be released. And then I got a few of those letters, and so he was being held. And I found out he was finally released this year, January 31st of this year. And he was sentenced to 20 years, and he did 17. And the detective who worked the case came to me after it was over, and he said, I don't know who you were back then. I'm not even sure I want to know, but whatever it is you're doing now, keep doing it, because it seems to be working. And see, that's Alcoholics Anonymous speaking for itself. And I love to go to H&I. I've had the privilege of going to a lot. You know, I've been back to that juvenile hall and taken panels in there, and I got to go back into that nut house and take a panel in there and sit in the very music room, the very same music room where we used to sit in there, and we used to tongue all of our meds and then spit them into a cup, and then the one lucky girl would get the cup that night. And and you could tell who it was by whoever it was laid out in the hallway about an hour later. But I've gotten to bring panels back into that, and then I get to go up to this prison, and I've gotten to know some of these guys. And the first time I went up, I did not want to be the one that told them I had testified against one of them. And he wasn't in that room, but you know, I just didn't want to be the one. And I went up there, and after I talked, they came up to me and they said, you know, you're in the safest place you could be. It was as fine a meeting as I've ever been to. As fine a meeting and as spirited as a group. And some of those guys have talked to me, and some of those guys are in there working these steps for real, you know, and they've made real amends. And they come and they ask me questions, and some of them have found a way. Some of them are never getting out, and they know it, and they've found a way to be useful. inside those walls, and some of them walk as free spiritually as you and I do. And that's not to say that they wouldn't trade places with us out here, but they found a way, accepting their situation, to make themselves useful and happy inside those walls. Alcoholics Anonymous works wherever it's worked. So, and you know, sometimes I go into the, I took panels into the Twin Towers, the county jail, and I'd see some of those women. And it's always really fun to run into one of those women outside in here and have her say, oh, you know, you spoke at one of those panels and that I got to go to. That's always fun. But what's more effective to me is when I go in there and one of those women grabs my sleeve and says, you know, I used to be secretary of that big meeting over there. Or I used to sponsor 10 women, you know, and now they're sitting on the inside and they can't stop drinking. I'd like to tell you that was the only, our book says that we work these steps so that we can walk through the sure troubles and rough spots ahead. People that never drink get cancer and get raped and get robbed and stuff happens. They get foreclosed. Stuff happens to people who never drank. So why wouldn't it happen to us? Alcoholics Anonymous has just given me a foundation on which I stand, and I can look you in the eye, and I can live from a real place, and I don't have to pick up a drink, and that's the start I get. And I got into a bad business deal with another boyfriend. Oh my God, I had just terrible. Judgment, you know, a terrible picker. I don't know if it's a broken picker or what, but he said all the right things, and I loaned him a bunch of money, and I ended up bankrupt, long story short, at 10 years sober, and thinking, you know, God, maybe I've just had a good run. 10 years is a pretty good sober run, and I was really down. It's good if you're going to be in a relationship to be in the same one he's in, first of all. So I had to change home groups. I've changed home groups 3 times. I got another sponsor, and I've had to start over in Alcoholics Anonymous a few times without drinking, you know, and that's okay. I just had to get up and start over, get busier than I've ever been, you know, recommit and dive in. And I had to pay back a lot of money I didn't feel like I needed to pay, and I got better. And I got busier than I'd been in a long time, and I got better. And the reason that I know that I have none of those other additional disorders that they talked about in the Nut House is because when I apply the steps and the traditions and the concepts of Alcoholics Anonymous to my life, I get better. I get better, and I haven't needed anything since September 25th, 1987. I guess I forgot to tell you that, didn't I? But, You know, and I've always had a sponsor. I need to be a sponsor. I need to be out there and active. And sticking out my hand was the best thing I ever learned how to do. I stick out my hand, and those 2-hour coffee breaks get back down to 10 minutes long, you know, like they're supposed to. And it allows me to walk and look you in the eye and look your wife in the eye. And we all like that a whole lot. My daughter came back to live with me, and I got to be present at the birth of my first grandson. I have 2 now. They're 9 and 15, and I've gotten to be spend a lot of time with them when they were both little. Now I'm just grandma, and they're growing up. But I hope they'll come back around sometime. But they love seeing me come, and they've never seen me drunk like their mother. And I had become every bit the parent that I had sworn I'd never become. And I had to come in here and tell you that I was controlling my daughter by beating her. By hitting her, and you didn't send me away. You just taught me how to do it differently. And over time, my daughter forgave me, and she came back to live with me. And my father doesn't have to sit up nights anymore. I told you, watching the news to make sure his daughter's name isn't on the list of the victims of the serial killers of the day. And I sat about a year ago watching my daughter graduate from Cal Poly Pomona with a bachelor's degree, and she's going to be a probation officer. That apple ran screaming from the tree, you know. My mom was the hardest. You know, it took her, She just passed away last July. She died of end-stage liver disease, and she died a long, slow, painful death. But we were good. You know, the last 15 or 20 years of her life, we were good. But she was the hardest in the beginning. She was hardest to get off for me to get off of her side of the street. And about 2 years before I got sober, my baby sister committed suicide at the age of 17, and it took her all weekend to die. And while she lay on life support in West Covina Hospital, the family would be in the waiting room, and I'd go out to the car, and I'd drink, and then I'd come back in, and I'd rake my mother across the coals, and I'd talk to her in a way a daughter should never talk to her mother, especially when her baby lay dying in the next room. And I don't know how you make amends for that, except that I started by calling her once a week and trying to find out how I might add to her life instead of take for a change. And it required listening. And not expecting anything from her, listening. And I found that I got a whole lot more from her, you know. Over time, we got very close. And so much so that 8 years ago when my baby brother died of this disease, he was 30 years old, 6'10", 160 pounds, when he lay on life support in a Spokane hospital. Little pinholes in his heart from doing crank, and he wasn't going to stop drinking. Mercifully, when he died, I got to go and be the kind of a daughter my mother needed while she buried yet a second child. And I don't know what kind of pain that is for a parent, really, but I know that this time, because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I got to be part of the solution rather than part of the problem. And when she passed away, we were good. We were good. And right after that, I went to be of service. You know, Matthew M. always says, sometimes the next indicated thing is waking up and turning the alarm off and going off to work. And he said, then sometimes the next indicated thing is something so big it'll make your heart explode. And right after July, it was August, I got to go give a talk in Arizona, and my friend Doug was going to be there too, and we were very excited about that because we sit two seats away from each other every Saturday morning at our workshop, and we crack up and stuff. I've never really got to spend any time, so I thought we might have lunch or something, and we got out there, and I spoke Friday night and Saturday morning. We had breakfast, and then we had lunch, and then we sat by the pool, and he talked Saturday night. We flew home from Phoenix on Sunday, and he asked me to a play, and as he puts it, we've been playing ever since. And you know, you just never know. I was 51 years old, 21 years sober, and I've had friends who have been married and divorced more times than I'd had dates in sobriety, and I had to accept it. I learned how to have fun being single, but I really appreciated God looking down and saying, okay, maybe it's time, and we're going to be married next May, and... A lot of you know him. You know, he's not like those simmering guys that I used to go for. I mean, he's perpetually joyful, and he's got no recent prison experience, and he's nonviolent, and I almost missed him, you know. I'm going to close with this little story because it just, we talk about transformation. All weekend we've heard about transformation, And along the way, I don't know if this has ever happened to you, but sometimes I start to take myself a little too seriously. You know, maybe not in this room, maybe none of you, but I do. And it just creeps up on me again. You know, I don't know what, you know, sometimes God's momentum, and then I think I'm helping God, you know, whoops, and he's like back, woo, and I'm still going. And so I can get a little serious, you know, and I was 17 years sober and 47 years old, and I would just... a little tight, and my sponsees, I'm sure, were wondering, is she ever going to get laid? I don't know. I mean, we love her. I knew they loved me, but, you know, Jesus. So they're all learning how to help each other because they don't really want to call. And because I can take perfectionism and discipline to an art form, or, you know, and... I don't think they call it art, but, you know, whatever. Perfectionism doesn't mean you're perfect. It just means you're obsessed with the idea of being so. And so, I don't know, overly focused, whatever. And I've always had to do something physical in sobriety. It just helps, you know, it helps me. Rollerblading or the gym or whatever it was. And I'd get out on the beach and rollerblade. And so I had to give up surfing because surfing, you know, it was dangerous for me. My friend Lisa says it's more like being in a domestically violent relationship without actually having to have a boyfriend. And But I walked into a ballroom dance studio, and I had no idea what was going to happen. I had no idea. I didn't go searching for it. I just walked in. I'd seen it, and I thought it was going to be the next thing. And I went in, and I didn't know how stiff I'd become until I took my first rumba lesson. Now, to do the rumba, you've got to get a little wiggle on. You just do. It's just the way it goes. And about halfway into our lesson, my beautiful Haitian French teacher, he slapped his forehead and said, "Oh, Carla, do not try to dance like a good girl. I do not think they'll believe you anyway." In the 9th chapter of our book, it says, "Our dark past will become our greatest possession." I got very involved in ballroom dancing, and it reminded me of my 11th step. It reminded me to stay in the now when I'm not worried about the step I just took, and I'm not worried about the step I'm about to take, and I allow myself to be guided across the floor. I never really know what pattern I'm executing until it's done, and I love that feeling right now, right here. This is the presence of God right here, right now. And my friend Don Newcomb, a lot of you know him too. He came to me one time and he said, I was a little worried when he started that dancing thing. I was worried it would take you away and out of AA. You'd get so involved. And he said, but what I see now is that little girl who went to North Beach had to step aside so the lady who dances could come out. If you're new, I want you to stay, because like Vince Wye used to say, that God is going to come to you in a way that's so personal that there's going to be no denying that there is a God who can and will do something for you. Thanks for having me.